You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast on the Medics Academy Network.
Welcome back to the podcast. In this episode, we're going to kick off a three-part series on drug addiction and people that are addicted to drugs. So the reason why I wanted to do this is because some of the figures around drug addiction, just in the UK alone, said to cost £36 billion on the nation's public spending every year. This isn't just the what would be the classic cocaine, ecstasy, heroin or methamphetamines. This is everyday drugs such as alcohol and indeed tobacco. But it has such a burden on the healthcare system, and it's prevailing. So it's up and down the country. I've just spent the last 4 months in Canada, and they have a real issue there as well with drug addiction and people who are addicted to drugs. So what I wanted to do is really do this three-part series whereby we talk to different people from across the spectrum around drug addiction. So this first is, the first episode we're going to air is actually a rehash from the Restore podcast. So I did 50 episodes in the Restore podcast, gave it up in March of this year because of just an overwhelming burden of work. But I'm going to rehash a couple of the conversations from there, because one in particular from a drug rehabilitation specialist was absolutely fascinating, by a guy called Mark Dempster. So this episode is going to be a rehash of that episode from Mark. He had lived experience with drug addiction, but now counsels others, including A-list celebrities, around getting off drugs. But then we're going to also speak to a psychologist on drug addiction and get their perspective. And then we're also going to speak to a paramedic practice leader, so a paramedic specialist, on their perspective on drug addiction and people who are addicted to drugs. Just from the endemic use of drugs in various different areas and how we can look at it differently, how we can treat these people differently, and how we can potentially refer them differently as well. But this first episode is going to be from Mark Dempster. Mark was a fantastic guest on the Restore podcast. So he was a drug addiction specialist, like I said, with lived experience. So in this conversation, we look at the five stages of addiction. Look at common cognitive pitfalls. We look at sort of defining the UK stats as well. We look to see how people become addicted, so habit versus addiction. We look at the adage of dual diagnosis, and then we look at how we break the cycle as well, so different types of therapy, including CBT, DBT and ACT. I really do hope you enjoy this trilogy of interviews. They won't be sequential, so they'll be interspersed within other interviews as well, but there will be these three interviews which addresses drug addiction across the spectrum. Okay, please enjoy.
I had addiction to various drugs throughout the time, including alcohol, and then eventually I got clean, and then I went to college and I trained as a therapist, and I'd done lots of different qualifications. So I stopped the addictions that I had, then went to rehab, came out of rehab, trained and continued to train, and then along the way wrote a couple of books. So I wrote a biography and I wrote a self-help book, and now work as a Harley Street specialist in addiction.
Well, so you've really walked the walk, Mark, actually, from being addicted to substances to then be coming through that experience. If you don't mind me asking, what substances or what addictions?
Oh, yeah, everything, really. Right, okay, so, no, I've got no problem at all talking about it. So I started, like, sort of, as they always say, a sort of gateway drug, cannabis. I started with cannabis when I was quite young, when I was 15, and then I took everything, basically hallucinogenics. So I started like cannabis, and then I went through, it was like textbook progression really through all the different drugs really, until I got to heroin, there wasn't really crack at the time, it was freebase, but cocaine, and then to heroin, and then became sort of chronically dependent, physically dependent and psychologically dependent on heroin and cocaine and alcohol as well. So alcohol all the way through, and of course I was addicted to nicotine as well, but So, I mean, really everything, I was like a dustbin, really. When I think back and like my, you know, I work with a lot of clients that are quite specific around, it's like cocaine, it's like sex addiction, cocaine addiction. And they, you know, it's alcohol, they're quite manageable, they're quite, they're high functioning addicts, really. They hold down businesses and their chief execs organizations, working in finance or private equities or whatever it may be. And my addiction wasn't like that, but along the way I made a lot of money through criminal behavior to do with drugs, and all that money got spent on the addiction, really, eventually.
Yeah, indeed. Mark, I just like to, because you very much walked the walk and been through your own experiential journey through addiction, could you just, I suppose a really good place to start would be actually like the five stages of addiction, because, you know, putting this into context and front loading it with a few statistics, which I will do. It costs the NHS in excess of £36 billion a year. And, you know, the UK has been termed the addiction centre of Europe, or was the addiction centre of Europe before we came out of Europe. So it's a real issue, not only sort of medically, but it affects everything from the psychosocial life to family life to everybody's life. You don't need to be a healthcare professional for it to affect your life. But as in, you know, dealing with addicts, it affects every. And you've got this organic story. Could you maybe walk us through the five stages of addiction?
We start off with, of course, here's the stages. It's experimentation, and then regular use, then risky use, and then. And then dependence, and then addiction, right? But, and what you just said there about the whole, the cost to the NHS is, and we don't even really see the financial cost, but we don't see the psychological cost. We don't see the breakdowns in family units. Criminal justice, they used to say here, 5% of the crime is committed by 95% of the population. So we know, and if you look at legal aid fees, you look at how much it costs to keep people in prisons, then we look at the workforce, and we look at days off as a result of addiction. We also look at decisions that are made when people are under the influence, especially in financial, you know, there's a school of thought that think that the whole financial crisis, a lot of that was driven by cocaine and cognitive impairments, really, when they're making decisions on large funds. And so right, this is how it starts. It starts for most people that I know that have got addictions, is they get introduced. There's usually a perfect store for addiction as well. There's usually, for people that have addictive personalities, there's usually early exposure to drugs or alcohol. So there's some stats around, if you drink alcohol by the time you're 14, you're six times more likely to develop a problem than you would if you waited till you're 21. So, because the brain obviously is forming, it doesn't stop really developing till 24 or 25, they say, but certainly to 20 years. So if you get a young person who's like 14, 15, coupled with adverse childhood circumstances, so if they've got any trauma, any neglect, abandonment, family, mother or father, that's another massive factor. If you've got a mother or father that's got an addictive personality or an active addict, that's something like three or four times more likely to develop addictions than you would if you had a healthy family. So if you've got early exposure, peer pressure, coupled with adversity, and you've got sort of the perfect storm. So most people start off, they experiment. That's what I done. Started off, my friends were all smoking weed in the school that I was in. A bit of a crazy school, it was in Glasgow. It was rough. It was a rough school, a lot of social deprivation amongst all the pupils there, really. Well, not all the pupils, but a percentage. Then I've got a curiosity about drugs. I start taking an interest. I start to experiment. I don't know that I've got any predisposing factors, right? So they say 50% of, you know, 50%, they've done these things called the twin studies, and they could see that children of alcoholics or addicts are 50% more likely to be, there's a 50% chance that they're going to be addicts as well, or alcoholics. And so I start to experiment. I start to then use, I say to myself, oh, this is great. I really enjoy the buzz. I'm getting the dopamine, the neurotransmitters, you know, I'm getting flooded in the brain. You know, I don't realise time as a young child, really, that I've got a dopamine deficit as a result of the trauma that I had from childhood. So I take to it like a duck to water, and then put it to regular use. Then, of course, it goes into, you cross the line, right? You start to say, so at the beginning I'm saying, okay, I'm just smoking weed. I'm only going to smoke at the weekend. I'm never going to take hallucinogenics. I'm never going to take LSD. I would never take heroin. But all of that changes through time, because I rationalize. I've got a part of me, it's like a subpersonality that starts to give me information that's incorrect and says, oh, it's not, you know, it rationalizes and justifies why I could do other drugs. And then before I know it, I'm in the risky use and the risky behavior. And then I start to take a drug like heroin where there's a physical dependency. You get a physical dependency. But equally, it could be cocaine, and I could develop a psychological dependency. Now, as you know, well, in London, and as you talked about, the capital of drug use in the whole of Europe, is cocaine has become so normalised within the UK in the last 10 to 15 years, and the availability, and there's a lot of reasons why that is the case. But so then I'm in dependency, and then before I know it, I'm in full-blown addiction. Now, that trajectory, that sort of five stages, that could happen. For me, that took, say, maybe 5 or 6 years to get to the addiction stage, the end stage. But I know people that jumped, a lot of people who jumped from experimentation straight really into addiction. And I used to witness in council estates in Glasgow, you know, a lot of social deprivation. Kids that were like pre-puberty, like 14, 15 years old, they go straight into it and they'd start shooting up heroin, right? So there was no honeymoon period. There was no, like, it was like straight from, now, some of them young lads and girls would be like, they would have trauma, they would have, say, from neglect. And what drove some of that wanting to numb so quickly, and that lack of care for self, was the childhood adversity. So, yeah.
Yeah, what I'm getting from you there, Mark, is that, like you said, the social environment and or social deprivation really lends itself from a trifecta. So, like you said, you've got social deprivation, you've got potentially a modelling facet from a significant other, i.e. a parent, and or you the coercion from the group. And like you said, I think the worst facet about it is that you can be unaware that actually these are prevailing influences at that time. You're not aware that actually there's a substantial risk from all those impinging on you. But like you said, how important is, because I'm familiar, having been a paramedic for 20 years and worked with in London and dealing with the effects of addiction, and then seeing people who slip back into addiction, how important is it for them to change their social environment? Because and the reason I'm asking this question is because people who return to their social environment and their friendship groups, see, in my mind and my observational anecdotal observations, is they slip back into their addiction. Is that true from your perspective?
Absolutely. Look, they say in the 12-step fellowships, especially, they say, look, you've got to change your playgrounds, your playmates and your playthings. And they also say, if you sit in a barbershop long enough, you'll get a haircut. If you If I go and sit with the same people, now I've done this. I've personally done this in Glasgow. I was clean about 2 years, or it's maybe 2.5 years, and I went back to help some of my friends. I went to I never moved back to Glasgow, but I went to help them, and I found myself in a really tricky situation because I'd put myself into the lion's den again, and they were all like, now these guys have not changed. They're just exactly like they've always been. They're all involved in crime. They're all quite macho. They're all very much like don't show feelings, hard as nails sort of characters. I'm in there. I've been in a rehab. I've been going to these meetings. I've had therapy. I'm talking about my feelings all the time. And I go, not all the time, but I've became much more open and receptive to looking at myself, and I go back in to this situation, and they're shooting up heroin in this flat. I'm trying to take them to a meeting, and I found myself almost compromised because I triggered off this codependent, because I felt, oh, they don't like me. They don't like me anymore. They don't, I don't have the same kudos or respect that I had before, because I'm not talking the same language, the same rhetoric, right? So I found myself, and they were like sitting there and they says, come on, have a drink. And I'm like, no, I don't drink anymore because I'm in recovery and I'm like training to be a therapist. And they were like, you're what? You're training to be a, you know, and it was like, they were just, and I found myself slipping and I had to get out. I mean, basically, you know, I had to get out. I had to just like, I says, listen, guys, I'm just going to, it was two brothers, and I just says, listen, guys, I'm going to shoot off. The whole thing that makes somebody, like, I guess, determines success, whether somebody will stay and remain drug-free and alcohol-free and in recovery, is that they are changing as a person, right? The whole thing is, we always got to remember, is the drugs and alcohol are only the symptom. Addiction, that's only the out, that's the, look, that's the outward manifestation. That's the last thing that happens as I take the drink of the drug. But what goes on behind that and underneath the addiction is either trauma or distorted thinking a lot of the time, looking for validation, peer pressure. I mean, there's a whole set of circumstances, low self-esteem and oversensitivity. And that's the thing. So we have to change when you get clean and sober. You have to change, and you have to build up your self-esteem. You have to identify. It's like going up a down escalator. If I just stand still, I'm going down, right? If I keep walking up that escalator, I just carry on the path. You know,
that's fantastic, Mark. That's fantastic. To just, you know, it lends itself to the adage that, you know, you are the sum total of your five closest friends, because whether you like it or not, the community you choose to encompass yourself with or encircle yourself with does have influence on you. And, you know, that story you just told there is a fantastic example of that from a perspective of acceptance, really, because the group you hang around with, you want to be accepted by, and you're right, the normalization, they've got this normalization of deviance, and the more go on with this group, the more you normalize deviance, and that occurs in everyone's life to a lesser or greater extent. You know, the normalization of deviance, you might start the car without your seatbelt on, then you might think it's okay to check your text messages. Every so often you just don't wear your seatbelt, and then you start checking your text messages more whilst you're driving. And all the while you're on a spectrum and a journey of normalizing deviant behavior. And that's a micro example. And then you shift that to drugs, and then I'm just going to do this. I'll actually just do this. My friends are doing this. And you're normalizing deviance until it gets, like you said, to a place where you don't, there's no return. And the dependence hits before you're even conscious of your dependence.
Oh, completely, right? And what's interesting, like Tolstoy talked about this, and it becomes, it becomes, when you're in the drug world, and look, and I know it's just about the whole crime. Before I knew, I mean, crime and drug use, before, now, obviously you're already committing a crime when you're taking the drugs because it's illegal, but, you know, when you start selling drugs, what, and you start getting involved in importing drugs, say, for example, which I was involved with, is, it's like, before you know it, before I knew it, I was involved with a whole group of guys who were involved in really serious sort of serious crime, really, and distribution. And at the beginning, I felt out of my depth, completely out of my depth, right? Like, what am I doing here? Like, how have I found myself in this circumstance? Because they had all guns and shotguns. And then a year later, maybe even less, 6 months later, I was like talking the talk and just like, because we adapt all the time, we adapt to the environment. So I became like my environment, you know. So if I stop using drugs, I'm going to be influenced by that environment. So it's really important for me to seek out and find a new group of people, a new social group. And that's what often we do in 12-step groups, is we find a whole group of other people who are similar to us, who are like-minded of addiction problems, but they're doing different. Now, also there's this thing too, is you can channel the addictive energy into a positive thing. Look, lots of famous, look, I've got famous friends, I've got friends with Russell Brand, I've got friends with Davina McCall, Boy George, Eric Clapton, all those guys I know, right? Now, the thing is, they've just channeled that energy into something productive. They've channeled it into music or acting or comedy or whatever it is. So when you get clean and sober, you can channel it to, if you have goals, you set goals and you try and achieve those goals. And you, so that tenacity and resilience, because there's transferable skills that, you know, like when you're an addict, you've got to get up every day and get money. If you've got a heroin, you've got to think of ways to get the money every day. So there is a skill within that. There's a tenacity and resilience to go to any lengths to get that drug. Now, I know it's deviant and I know it's criminal and I know it's, but, you know, if you can imagine, if you channeled that same type of energy and that sort of diligence and tenacity into a business enterprise, you'd be successful.
Yeah, indeed, absolutely. And that's a fantastic way to sort of pivot and shift the focus and mindset, Mark, actually. Mark, we've articulated the problem and we've also talked about the five-step journey. Can we just look at a few sort of treatment modalities for people? Is that okay? So you talked about this 12-step model and... could you just unpack that for...
Okay. 12-step model started, just really briefly, in 1953, Narcotics Anonymous was formed, 1935, Alcoholics was formed. Now, basically, the whole... historically, it was set up, it was... 12 steps came from really temperance movements in the beginning. However, it's not like that now. Later on, much later, there's a lot of atheists, agnostics go to 12-step meetings. The 12 steps, I mean, the steps are basically, one, we admitted we were powerless over our addiction, our life became unmanageable. Two, we came to believe a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, we made the decision to turn our will and our life over to God as we understood it. Now, God, for the atheists and agnostics, change the acronym and they say good, orderly, direction. So they take out the God, the existential concept, and they say good, orderly direction or group of drunks, or so they just change the word. Step four, we made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, we admitted to God to ourselves and being the exact wrongs. Six, we were entirely ready to have these defects of character removed. Seven, we humbly asked God to remove these shortcomings. Eight, we made a list of all people we'd harmed and became willing to make amends to them. Nine, we made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, we continued to take personal inventory and promptly admitted it when we were wrong. 11, we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him. And 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to addicts and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Now, the 12 steps are maybe less so than in America. Most residential rehabs in America use the 12 steps. 85% of rehabs in America use the 12 steps as the core sort of philosophy. Obviously, they do use cognitive behavioral therapy as well, sometimes DBT, sometimes ACT, as we might talk about as well. But so they'll use other bits and pieces or different components of different therapies. The 12 steps... it's free, and there's lots of different 12-step groups. So for every type of addiction, you've got meetings for that. So for drug addicts, you've got Narcotics Anonymous. For marijuana, you've got Marijuana Anonymous. For cocaine, you've got Cocaine Anonymous. For alcohol, you've got Alcoholics Anonymous. For codependents, you've got Codependents Anonymous. For sex addicts, you've got Sex Addicts Anonymous. For gamblers, you get... So there's a whole... And even now that they've started to see that gaming is a real problem with young people and pornography as well, which is more Sex Addicts Anonymous, but they've got Gamers Anonymous in the UK only in the last few years. So it's a really good model. It works for a group of people. I'm not saying it works for everybody, but it's a good model to, and it's free, and you create a support network. And and now, because of the Zoom, everything's went online, so the Zoom meetings 24 hours a day.
One of my observations, Mark, and I just wonder if you could speak to this, is that in these groups, AA, NA, and others, what they celebrate is they celebrate successes. So if you say, you know, you've been clean for a week or a couple of days or however small the success, it's celebrated in the group. But also there's transparency, modeled transparency, so other people will be really honest, and then that breeds honesty breeds honesty. But also they celebrate your successes, and that seems to be, when I've observed it, a powerful effect, because there's you almost want that affirmation of success to be celebrated in the group, and that's motivation in and of itself to stay clean or be clean, that you can report good news to the group. Does that is that something that makes sense?
Completely. They celebrate sobriety time, and they say, you know, like every year, look, I'm now 24 years, 2 months. So every year on the 4th of December, I go on and I say, okay, it's my birthday. It's like, it's recognized as your birthday, like, and say, oh, it's my birthday. I'm 24 years or 23 years, whatever it is. And everybody sort of cheers. And then, you know, now there is a downside to this, right, as well. If you don't, Stacey, but they call it the abstinence violation effect. So when somebody breaks their abstinence, so say they're 20 years clean and then they relapse, the shame that they feel, now not necessarily, no one in the group, right, would go, oh, like, you know, so why are you so stupid? That would never happen, right? But the person themselves really feels their own shame because they broke the continuity of abstinence, you know. So, but there is, and look, there's no doubt about it. See, I go to meetings and I go to meetings in London, and I'm really fortunate. There's a great diversity in meetings in London. You've got, you know, it's like, and there's meetings for every day. There's meetings, there's lesbian gay meetings, there's transgender meetings, there's atheist meetings, there's you know, ethnic, there's just lots of different single sex, male, female, there's meetings with particular topics. So the whole thing is about feeling not isolated anymore, being part of a community, getting a sponsor, working these steps, And by working the steps, so what you're trying to do is you're writing a list of the people you've harmed, and you're trying to repair the relationships with family, with friends. So if I stole somebody's video, a recorder, or I've done something, and if it's safe for me to do so, and I'm not going to harm them, I would go and I'd replace. Like I'd say, look, I'm really sorry. I remember I done this. I want to pay for the video. I want to pay some extra money as well. You know. So the whole idea is to free you from the shame, but also to rectify those relationships. And a big part of it, obviously, is the self-examination and looking at what is underneath. Why do I act addictively? What is it I'm running away? Why is it so uncomfortable being me? What is it at the core that's going on that I feel that I've got to numb all the time? I've got to distract myself.
Mark, that's fantastic. And it gives me a real insight into not only the mindset but the fruition of rehabilitation, really. So just for listeners, can we just quickly visit some of the therapies such as CBT, DBT, ACT? So cognitive behavioral therapy, how does it seek to address addiction?
Cognitive behavioral therapy is like our thinking determines how we feel, and therefore then that can determine how we're going to behave, right? So if we've got cognitive distortions, right, as in, and cognitive distortions are like things like black and white thinking or jumping to conclusions, where we jump to conclusions about something, but we don't know the evidence. We've already made up our mind before the conversation's even finished that this person wants to leave me, or they wanted to hurt me somehow. There's other cognitive, like catastrophizing or filtering. They call this other thing called filtering, where we just only look at the negatives, or overgeneralization. So there's a whole set of ways that we can react, which will then create certain feelings in us that then create certain behaviors. So they look to address that and change some of those things. But then what they try and do with CBT is you learn how to delay and distract and respond to cravings. So when you're they do this a lot when we're in rehab. They used to say, look, you're craving for the drink or the drug now, but the craving will only last a couple of minutes. So imagine, so they'll use sort of visual tools like, oh, imagine it's like a wave. So the craving's the wave, but the wave's going to crash on the beach. So it'll get bigger and bigger, and then it'll crash. So just hold on for the next 10 minutes. Hold on for it. Just don't use for the next hour. You're not going to use. Now, what happens long-term with that is 24 years later, you're still not used. It's like, so you're delaying gratification. And then they'll teach you stuff like identifying dysfunctional ways of thinking, developing and practicing how to be assertive. You know, how do you deal with when you've got to go back into social groups and you don't drink anymore, being assertive around that and asking for water, you know, like a sort of language you use as well. And then they'll do stuff like how to face problems, how to deal with life, you know, situations. Because a lot of like, we've got, you know, in the UK also, we've got a very binge drinking culture, right, with alcohol. People use it to alleviate stress all the time here. And, you know, what would be a much better mechanism is if we've got any problems or stressful situations, we deal with that anxiety or fear and get solution focused around it and go, okay, look, I've got this going on. I want you to reach for the drink to take away these feelings. But really what I should do is I should focus on resolving the problem or certainly writing about the problem so that I can see it from a different perspective. So they use tools like that, utilising healthy support systems, making lifestyle changes, using exercise. So CBT really works at, like, on a number of different levels. It's a really useful tool to dealing with the irrationality that underlies addiction.
Indeed. So, Mark, could you speak to just a few of the other therapies, if indeed you use them, if you advocate for them? So would you use dialectical behaviour therapy?
DBT is great as well, right? Because DBT, look, I'll tell you what is funny about these therapies. CBT, DBT, and act. They're all similar in some respects, right? It's just different language. But however, what I like about DBT is uses influence. Now, DBT was used a lot for eating disorders and borderline personality disorder. A lot of, and it's not just women that have the eating disorders. Lots of men have eating disorders, and lots of men have borderline as well, personality disorder. So it was used as a therapy for that, and initially. But what they practice is how they use the DBT. How you use DBT is, how do I regulate my emotions? How do I, when I'm starting to feel stressed, or I'm starting to feel really frightened, or I'm feeling really angry, what tools am I going to implement to deal with that emotional state? And how do I sort of bring myself down if I'm really adrenalized? So a big part of it's on emotional regulation. A big part's also on mindfulness practice, like right here in the now, there's nothing to worry about. You know, lots of our fears, I mean, we're either in regret about the past or we're in fear about the future, right? But right this second, I mean, I could sit here right now and think, oh, you know, I've probably got cancer, I'm going to get cancer, but none of that's real, right? It's the Buddhists would say this all the time, isn't it? Like, the only thing that is real is right this second. Our conversation right now, that's the only reality that is. So they use mindfulness, they use interpersonal effectiveness, so how to deal with people and relationships and family and friends, and how to create good communications with them, which is really important. It's a skill that we need, right? And especially when you come from addiction, right? A lot of the relationships are just so broken, tarnished. And the last one is called distress tolerance. So how do we deal with the stressful situations? That goes in with, I guess, the first one, emotional regulation. But the stress tolerance is really important. It's a bit like stoicism, really, in a way. The old Stoics used to say, no matter how much pain, no matter how much emotional pain you feel, it's not going to kill you. If it was physically going to kill you, you would already be dead. So that means that you can deal with more pain. You know, like the Marcus Aurelius and Seneca and all that, they used to take on board like Socrates and Aristotle and Plato. And so some of that stuff, the Stoic stuff is brilliant as a tool also for addiction. Yeah, so that's the DBT. I really recommend it. Did you want me to talk about ACT as well?
Just acceptance and commitment therapy, actually, because I think that could be a powerful tool. You've probably got way more of an insight than I do. But yeah, if you could talk about acceptance and commitment therapy, that would be fantastic.
The acceptance and commitment therapy I haven't used much myself, but what I do know about it, because I know that it's used a lot in the drug field and it has been used a lot, and what the central themes to it really are, that as opposed to like the if you think of DBT and you think of CBT, what the core principles of acceptance and commitment therapy is really around cognitive diffusion, right? It's to try to detach from your inner experience by interacting or relating to them differently. So you're whenever you've got any cognitive distortions, you're trying to see it from a different perspective. They're just using sort of different terminology. The acceptance bit of it is a bit like the mindfulness part, right? Is the acceptance that allowing thoughts and feelings to arise without trying to change them, trying to change their form or frequency. So you're basically like, there is no good or bad, but thinking, well, it's Shakespeare as well, Hamlet. He said, he was like, there's nothing good or bad, but thinking makes it. It's mainly our judgment about the situation that creates whether it's bad or good. But if we can separate ourselves from the judgment and see, I think it was C.S. Lewis said, he said there was two goods. There's good when something's good, and there's complex. And complex goods as bad at the time. Now, this could be something like, you know, if you think of something like a breakup from a marriage, right? And at the start, I think, God, this is really bad. But actually, 6 months later, or a year later, I think, thank God I'm out of that marriage. That was a crazy marriage that I was in. So I think it goes back, this goes back to acceptance. That's a very, like, a sort of spiritual principle, really, is that, okay, I feel this. This is what I feel. I'm not going to try and change it this now, but I'll let myself feel. I'm not going to change. They use obviously mindfulness as well. They also, one of the other principles is self-understanding, letting go of concrete and inflexible thoughts or ideas about oneself, and moving to understanding oneself within the context of the situation. So that, I think that is about the limited beliefs. You know, when we do like shoulds and must, I must be like this or I should be this, this sort of inflexible stance. So we're open to change and we're open to see things from a different perspective. And one of the last principles is, well, two last ones is values, learning what's most important to oneself, family, service, etc. So getting a value system. Look, when you're in the addiction, when people are in addictions, and values are compromised all the time. So we're trying, it's really important to find out what our value system is when we're clean and have a set of values and principles to live your life by. And then the last one is committed action, effort to empower behavioural change, continuing on. So I think, ACT is really useful.
So, Mark, just to come in to land on the conversation, just mindful of time, could you just speak to the, so in the podcast, there's a real theme around self-care. And it seems, you know, that not only do we need to carry through these principles when we're at work, but very much when we're not at work. Could you just speak to the adage of self-care and to the adage of consistency? Because everything you've spoken about, Mark, over the past hour is not for just here and now, it's not for listening, it's for future iterations of yourself. And like you said, it's through the modulation of feeling, because one of the most powerful things I've learned, Mark, in my 41 years is you're not how you feel. You are not how you feel. Feelings are markers, and you should pay attention to feeling, but it's not, you shouldn't identify with feeling and as the sum total of who you are. Feelings will be up and down and here and there. And actually, the mindful practitioner or the mindful person can transcend feelings and can apply a consistency of thought and principle beyond despite feeling. Could you kind of sort of just speak to that as a final question?
I think definitely. Look, the self-care thing is a massive part of the recovery process. And now, forget even just about addiction. I mean, generally, right, widespread society. What you said was really absolutely true here. Our feelings about our feelings, because look, I always go back to it. Look, our thoughts aren't facts, right? We have hundreds of thousands of thoughts a day. Our feelings aren't truths. Our feelings are continually changing. They're like clouds in the sky. I can feel like I'm on this conversation now. I can feel quite passionate and elated. 2 minutes from now, I can feel quite, I've got to go. I can feel down. You know, so we can't get too attached to our thoughts or feelings, because we are continually changing as human beings. Like, we're developing, or our sense of self and who we are is changing all the time as well, right? Depending on a number of different factors, environmental, people, situations, right? Self-care, right? You know, look, I send a message to myself. How I live my life is I'm disciplined, right? I get up in the morning, right? So I do a set of routines every day that give a clear indication to me that I care about me as a person, right? So I'll go and I'll go for a run, I'll do some exercise, I'll have a coach. You know, there's certain things that I do that I don't want to do, right? I never really want to do any of this, because there's another part of me that's quite lazy and undisciplined and doesn't want to feel any uncomfortability. So I'm very aware there's a part that just wants to eat pizza and just sit in front of Netflix and not do any exercise, not engage with people, isolate. Now, what I do know, mental health-wise, right, there's a certain set of actions that bring me closer to the man that I want to be, and there's a set of actions that will take me further away from it. And so if I want to be a man of integrity and character, look, this goes back to Socrates. Look, Socrates, they killed Socrates because he stood up, his value system was such that at the time, they were saying, look, this is the way it is, and you can't be seeing this stuff because this is really hypocritical with what we believe. So they forced him to have a cup of hemp. They says, look, this is the way it is. Either you denounce your value system or you drink this cup of hemlock. And as he put the cup of hemlock to his mouth, he says, I know I've had a good life. He was like old at that time I think he was 55 or something. So he was old in terms of then Rome for his age. But basically he said, well, I'm going to follow my value system. Now, how that relates to me is that not that I'm going to drink a cup of hemlock, but I is that the self-care thing, I know that it reinforces a message that I like myself and I care about myself. So if I eat certain foods, if I eat the right foods, I mean, it's not that I don't have treats, but I'm disciplined with myself. And I'm also very disciplined. So that's on a physical level. So I'll do actions on, because there's different parts. Obviously, there's my emotional well-being, there's my mental well-being, and there's emotional, mental, spiritual, and physical. So if I look after my physical well-being, then it's also how do I look after my emotional well-being? Who do I surround myself with? Like, what kind of people do I surround myself with that enhances, that nurtures my emotional well-being? And who are the people that I avoid? I avoid aggressive and loud people, right? Because they're vexations to the spirit. I don't need to be around people. What do I do for my sort of mental recovery, for my mental well-being? What I realise is that if I stagnate and I'm not learning, that's another way. So another way that I self-care is by finding things that I'm curious about, or hobbies or interests or things that I want to learn. And when I do that, that's like self-care. And also, without believing in something existential, but if I do meditation, there's factual information about the power of meditation, you know, where they see the effect on the brain and bear in mind our brain plasticity, our brain's changing. It can change continually. Like, it's a 3-pound organ that there's so much can be, as in when you change certain neural pathways in the brain, what effect that has on the brain as a whole. So if I follow a sort of spiritual practice or a meditation practice, that has such a really a positive effect on me. We don't behave in a manner we suppress, like our feelings, that we've got an ability to talk about what's going on for us to close friends or therapists or somebody that we can, you know, and that we don't compromise, we don't, basically compromise any of our value system, try not to compromise our value system, so get into subjugate yourself in any way and people please, and we do things that we don't want to do that's harmful to ourselves. So we've got to be, I think in life we've got to be assertive, you know, try and practice not aggressive, not passive, but try and be assertive and create sort of robust boundaries.
That's fantastic. Mark, that's fantastic, because that's the dichotomy we're after. We're assertiveness, but not aggressiveness, not passivity. And it's always a dichotomous game, really, because like you said, it's around getting a healthy mix of mindsets together, but also a healthy mix of people that can that can cause you to bring out the best in yourself. I just to your point, actually, I heard a fantastic interview with Michael Phelps, the multi-gold winning Olympian. And he was just saying, how do you treat your body? Do you treat it like a Ferrari, or do you treat it like an old banger? You know, how do you, what's your approach to yourself? And that notion is towards you, the acceptance and self-care and self-love. You know, do you feed it properly with, do you treat it like a Ferrari? Do you feed it with salad and nutrients and vitamins, or do you abuse it and or treat it, you know, with junk food and or drugs? And it, you know, he said the mindset really is that you have to shift into thinking you're a high performance vehicle, and what are you putting in, because what you're putting in you will get out, both physically, spiritually and mentally. And my challenge, what I thought, gosh, that's such an insightful comment, because if you can get up every morning and think, right, I'm going to treat my body and my mind like a Ferrari.
What brings happiness or what brings contentment in life, and the five things were exercise, always to be learning, right? So if you're exercising physically, exercising, learning for the brain, connection with others, right? The big one as well, connection. They done this thing called the Glasgow effect years ago, why people in Glasgow were dying, mortality rates were really low, and they were saying it was because the men, especially among men in Glasgow, they were not connecting with other human beings. They were just isolating. So connecting with others, altruism, right? So giving something as well, being kind. Now we know that releases a lot of serotonin. When we're giving, we're doing something charitable, we're doing something kind for someone else, that releases the serotonin. And the fifth one was curiosity about life. So to be curious about life, to be have a zest for life, that, you know, to be grateful, really, you know. And you know, whether it's doing a gratitude list in the morning and saying, like, really looking at, look, man, God, you know, I think I've got it, but I'm so fortunate. You know, I've got good health, I've had a great life, and just seeing, you know, the good things in life. So those five things, I think, if we're doing that, so definitely mind, body, you know, and if we're, and that Ferrari, that's definitely the way to go, really, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, absolutely. From an imagistic perspective, I think, you know, you just having that in your mind and sort of treating yourself as such. But absolutely everything you're saying, actually, Mark. Mark, it's been fantastic talking to you, mate. Just for listeners that have been with us for the conversation, how can people find you, Mark?
Oh, yeah, just go on to, if you want to see me as a therapist, I've got a website, and it's Mark Dempster Counselling, www.markdempstercounselling.com. And if you want to find any of the books that I've wrote, just put my name, Mark Dempster, and it's on Amazon, Nothing to Declare or The Ongoing Path. So you should find me, no problem, on email. My email's mark@markdempstercounselling.com as well.
You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast on the Medics Academy Network.